You're listening to one in a series of podcasts from the 2009 High Ed Web Conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Well, thank you for coming. Good afternoon. My name is Lance Merker. I'm with OmniUpdate, and I'm joined by Michael Gasparino from SUNY Stony Brook. Now, OmniUpdate is a web content management vendor, and Michael Gasparino is not. And I'm representing the technology part of this presentation, and Michael's presenting the use case aspect of this. And the topic of the hour, of course, is using XML to create an online course catalog. So before we begin, maybe we can get a quick read of hands. How many people have already done this, and you're just here to see if we did it right? Fair enough. All right, fair enough. Thanks for the honesty there. Of course, there's many different ways this can be done, and I think this is a pretty exciting one. And again, we've got a good use case against it already, and we're going to show you how it can be done using XML, whether you're using OmniUpdate or not. All right, so let's go through the quick agenda here. We've got, first of all, an XML primer. So how many of you here are XML, XSL experts, users? Okay. All right, good. Well, we're going to start with just a quick primer. I mean, this is really a five-minute overview of what XML is and what it can do. We'll talk then specifically about the SUNY Stony Brook case and the course catalog that they had originally in print, talk about their need for change. Michael's going to go through this part, talk about how they work with the CMS to make it possible, and then ultimately where they are today. And then we'll talk more about lessons learned. So with that, let's start with an XML primer. So real simple, real high-level stuff. But think about it this way. In the beginning, there was SGML. We don't have to go back 40 years here, but let's go back 25 years or so. In the beginning, there was a standard that was set. And to our advantage, one of the reasons we're all here today, is that one of the great things that happened from that was HTML. So HTML is effectively a subset of SGML and something that conforms to the SGML standards. And it's a wonderful markup language for web pages, right? That's why we all have jobs today. It's a good thing. Well, HTML, as good as it may be, as exciting as it was back in the early 1990s, it wasn't perfect for some of the things that we were working on. It wasn't perfect for data. So, fortunately, there is another markup language that came along that's also a valid SGML language, and it's called, of course, XML. So XML is really a extensible language, hence the X in the word, and it was truly great for data. So while HTML is really a markup language for web pages, XML is a markup language for data, right? Simple high-level overview, but let's put it all into perspective. Now, what does this mean? Well, of course, this means that XML isn't by itself usable for web pages. It's really not designed for that at all. And yet, we're about to talk about that. So this is where it gets interesting. But what is XML? In a nutshell, XML is really a way to organize data and then let machines take over to read that organized data and do wonderful things with it. So how do we do these wonderful things? Well, again, XML by itself is not enough. We need more. We really need something to style that and to present it in a particular format. And that's where XSL comes in. So XML plus XML gives us really what we want because we've got something called XSLT, which will transform XML into virtually anything, virtually any file format that we want, applying styles from XSL, applying CSS if we're talking about web pages, and doing some pretty wonderful things to boot, automating huge processes that we all take advantage of in some way, shape, or form, perhaps today, particularly in the world of CMS, where I live. So from this pairing of XML and XSL, driven by an XSLT processor, we can output files such as HTML, CSV, TXT, PDF, whatever you can dream up and whatever you can do with the right XSL, maybe a little XSLFO if necessary for PDFs, you can output some pretty amazing files. All right, so now let's talk about XSL template magic for a moment here, because this is really where the rubber meets the road in the CMS world when we talk about XSLT. So XSL in a content management system, as many of you perhaps already have tried, is a pretty powerful tool for driving the templates that you want to use in your CMS. So if the page is represented here perhaps by XML content of some kind, and we apply an XSL style sheet to that page, and we consider perhaps other pages that are based on that exact same XSL style, and we process that with XSLT, what do we get? Well, we get pages that look alike other than the content. The template magic of XSL is very apparent, very tangible in the content management world. So this is really cool. We can take advantage of this. In fact, obviously the real promise of this is we change that XSL file, we republish the website, and we get the same content automatically transcribed into a different look and feel on the website. So that's one of the advantages, obviously, of XML and XSL, but that's not why we're here today, is it? Why we're here today is because we can do so much more. Now, let's think about this. We're about to jump into the use case study here, but if you think about the data that's stored in the database, it can easily, I say with a smile, be output as XML in one way, shape, or form, either by the database engine itself, perhaps there's a mechanism to output the XML directly, or simply by transcribing that and generating that XML from another process, perhaps using XSLT. But in the end, you can automate this process and make this very bulletproof, such that you get XML that you predict and expect on a periodic basis, perhaps, right? Now, what you can do with that, of course, is you can apply XSL to it, you can apply an XSLT transformation process to that, and lo and behold, you can add additional XSLs to that and output that to all formats simultaneously. So a web page, a CSV file perhaps, PDF, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the data that's stored in that database silo, if it's formatted well, if it's organized properly, it's in XML, and it's transformable into various different sources automatically. So now, we're going to get to the real reason that we're here today, and that's how do we do this and how do we automate the process of a course catalog? Well, we kind of went through the basics of it. These are the building blocks that we need. This is really all we need to know. It gets as simple as this. So now I'm going to turn it over to Michael Gasparino, who's going to talk for a moment about how they used these building blocks to do some pretty magical things. Mm-hmm.
Hello. I know this is the Propellerhead track. I am not a Propellerhead, so bear with me. I'm a content manager at Stony Brook. I work in the Office of Communications. We have a small staff of about 5, and we don't have any developers. So when this project came up, we turned to Omni Update for help, and they've done a great job with us. The undergraduate bulletin was the printed bulletin was printed every 2 years, and of course it was out of date. About 500 pages long. And of course, it was out of date the moment it was sent to the printer. And not having worked on the print bulletin prior to this, we were amazed at how many changes came in after the bulletin went to the printer. I mean, literally within a couple of days. It just seemed like certain departments didn't understand the dead in deadline. Then we were told that that wasn't uncommon, which surprised us. The Office of Communications pays for the production and has paid for the production of the bulletin. And since 2003, 4 of these 2-year editions were printed and cost almost $200,000 for our office. So that's a lot of money. The previous online version of the bulletin was just the PDF pages of the printed bulletin. grouped into 8 or 9 sections. And the bulletin was built in Quark, and the online updates, it was a 2-year bulletin, but every semester would be updated. And the updates consisted just of the PDFs with new text in red and deletions struck through, and they were just posted up. So like I said, highlighted in red with strike throughs, and the PDFs weren't created with accessible tags. And the bulletin was basically created from scratch every 2 years. So that's what we were doing. Incentives for change. Just back in the summer of 2008, within the span of a couple of days, literally, we were approached independently by 3 different people. First was our own director of production. Second was Disability Support Services. And the third was the editor of the undergraduate bulletin. They all had the same question. They wanted to know, could we do this better? One of the reasons was saving money. New York, like many states, instituted tremendous budget cuts. And, you know, paper costs money, and a lot of things are being pushed to the web. Like I said, Disability Support Services raised the issue of inaccessibility. And Going Green, the sustainability movement. Actually, at Stony Brook, we have a separate campus at Southampton dedicated to sustainability with majors in things like environmental studies and ecosystems and human impact. So it's big. And in the last few months, beyond the bulletin, we've taken our faculty staff newsletter. That's no longer a printed document. That's online. And the big phone book that we used to print out every year with everybody's phone number in it, we don't do that anymore either. We have a much smaller directory and told people that if they want somebody's phone number, they can go to the website. Maintenance also. Again, this bulletin was just built in Quark. It was a big drain on resources. And like I said, the usability, it was really not very usable at all. Just following a trend, I mean, since 2005, you could see we printed almost 50,000 copies of the undergraduate bulletin. And just to give you an idea, Stony Brook has about 24,000 undergraduate and graduate students. So that number went down the last few printings each year to the point where 2009-11, which was the first fall 2009 is when that came out, we printed only 16,000 copies. But you could see number of left over from 2007-2009, we printed over 30,000. We still have over 16,000 left over, piled up in boxes in some storehouse somewhere. And we printed 16,000, and that really, we really wanted to print, you know, much less than that. But some people are resistant to change, so we printed, basically they decided to print out about as much as they distributed the last time just to kind of cover themselves. But we felt that we could have printed much, much less. So, the solution. Export source data from PeopleSoft. We use PeopleSoft. I know different universities used to have different systems. Export it as XML. OmniUpdate created the XSL for both the front matter, which is the policies and regulations and general university information, as well as the course information pages. All the bulletin pages can be bulletin pages can also be printed as PDFs, and we'll show you that later. You can print out a PDF for an individual program, just the courses, the entire bulletin if you wanted to, and it's easy to archive each bulletin edition. And there's also a very good search, course search and keyword search built into the bulletin. So let's see. Let me show you how this works. Here we go. Okay, so this is the bulletin. You can see here printable versions. Like I said, if you wanted to print the whole thing out as a big PDF, you can. If you want to print just all the course descriptions, you can. You see we've got it divided up into different sections. The overview, like I said, is just basically general university information. Now you can go straight to what you want to go to, and all of this content is managed in the CMS. Same thing, policies and regulations. You want to go look up a policy. Now, instead of, you know, going to a 28-page or 30-page PDF to find, you know, information on advanced placement credit, it's very easy to find, so it's much more usable. Programs and courses, you can browse through them in this manner. So if you wanted to go find English, there's the general information. You've got degree and requirement information there. You can see on the left here, every program has the divided up into different sections. So course sequence, the courses, and the course descriptions are here. And if you go into degrees and requirements, you'll see also that you can also, if you click on one of the courses, it'll take you from that page directly to the description for that particular course. And then, like I said before, if you wanted PDFs of the course, you can go, you can get that as well. So if you wanted just the PDF of the program for art history, you can get it there. If you just wanted to print out the courses for art history, you could do that as well. So again, just different, being able to output different things. And then course search. A little bit slow. You can come in here. You can do perform a course search, search everything in bio. And then we also have so then if you wanted to do search every all the 200, you could do that. And then there's a keyword search also. So if you wanted to come in here and title, so I don't know, international. And then that'll come up as well. And this will search the entire bulletin, not just the I chose by title, so anything with international in the title will come up there as well. And that's a nice, obviously a nice feature that to have in there. So that's it. So much from our perspective, much better than. And I don't know how many of you guys, if your course catalog or undergraduate bulletin were just PDFs thrown up on the website, but we found that this is much more useful. And when we rolled it out, before we launched, we had one of our student groups take a look at it, and they were very happy with this. Much more useful to them. But also for the folks who have to update and publish to edit the bulletin, much more easy to maintain moving forward. So... The courses, there are XML files for each of the individual courses. So there are there's program XML files for each of the different programs, and then the front matter, like I said, is all just maintained in the CMS itself. So there are. I'm sorry? Yeah, it's all in PeopleSoft. That's what Stonebrook uses, so. You can do it on, if you need to. Basically, it's updated every semester, so every semester generally will take that information out of PeopleSoft and then upload the XML files. But if something changed, you can go ahead and just for a particular program, then just take that program XML and then just replace the XML. So you can do it as needed, I guess. Yeah, they'll get archived. What happens is you'll publish the bulletin. It'll be basically in a folder, so fall 2009, spring 2010, and then moving forward. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. FO, yeah. Mike.
I'm wondering, we've taken the first steps. We've got all our courses in our CMS from start to finish through our whole catalog. The challenge that I'm facing, we're certainly a school that we can't get away from print yet, just through lack of policy movement there or whatever want to provide me. But what I'm wondering is, I never want to give somebody a tool that results in more work for them. And the challenge I'm facing is, a catalog is more than just a list of courses. There's all the peripheral information, all the extra stuff you were showing us up there. And so I'm wondering, how do you go about maintaining all the other content in a way that doesn't inevitably result in more work for non-technical or do you have technical people maybe maintaining all that now?
All of that front matter type of the policies and regulations and university information. That's actually, again, just all in the content management system. And there's just two folks. The editor of the bulletin actually works in the College of Arts and Sciences, and it's him and one other person who were tasked with producing the print bulletin every 2 years and then maintaining it semester to semester. They were the ones who would, you know, update those Quark documents and upload those PDFs. Now, once all that information is entered into the CMS, you know, updating that is much easier now because it's all there. If they need to update a particular policy, they can just go in the head, you know, go and update that policy, and you know, it's much easier and faster for them because the initial work was a lot getting all that information into the CMS. I mean, a lot of it was just copy paste, but once it's in there, unless and one thing that, you know, we'll mention it later, just the idea of going to a new system like this was an opportunity. We thought, when I say we, the guy, folks on the web team, thought it was a good opportunity to take a look at the content and decide, what do you want in your bulletin? What don't you want in your bulletin? We've been printing this out. It was a printed document. It's much different than on the web. You wanted to kind of jam all of this information into this bulletin because you handed it out at the beginning of the semester or the beginning of the school year, and they wanted everything in there, everything about every aspect of the university. Well, now it's on the web. We have a university website. We have all of this stuff available in other places. So maybe you want to, bless you, you know, do you need all that information? Do you want to present it in a different way? The editor decided to, at least initially, basically leave it the way it was. Like you were saying, though, there are politics involved. Folks don't want to remove things from the bulletin. They wanted to keep it the way it was. But actually, as it turned out, as we went through this whole process, by the end, some of these same folks were sitting there saying, you know, gosh, do we really need that? And should we have that there? Or maybe we should do it this way, do it differently. But, you know, it's even so, it's easy to update the bulletin, remove things, add things. I don't think it's more work. I think it's actually quite, it's much less work. And the other advantage now is if we wanted to distribute the workload to departments and have them update their own particular section of the bulletin. So, you know, just like with the CMS, the biology department could not only update their website, they could update their piece of the bulletin. So now instead of just these two folks updating the bulletin, they've kind of parceled it out so the departments are responsible for their piece of the bulletin, and they are the approvers at that point. They're not, you know, getting an email from someone in biology saying, oh, we have changed this course description or whatever, or changed this degree requirement. The departments could update that stuff themselves, and then they're in a more of an approval role as opposed to actually going up and updating these pages. So.
So one of the powerful things about converging the PeopleSoft data that gets regenerated once every semester or as often as necessary based upon changes, and the content management front-end content that was perhaps managed by an individual before in the past or a very small group of people using Quark, which is now distributed, and the power of XSL, the convergence of all of that means that, you know, it's automating the process of updating the course information appropriately and giving the human touch to the front-end materials as necessary, all coming together, outputting on a periodic basis, which they can actually set on a schedule and so forth if they need to as well, such that they know that the information has been set and scheduled to go live at a certain date, regenerating properly live at that moment from PeopleSoft as necessary, combined with the other information and flowing appropriately. So it's, you know, it's simple stuff, but it's pretty darn powerful when you just put these three things together. The database, assuming that it can output XML or that you can extract the XML out of it, well-formed XML, the power of the CMS, whichever one you're using, and the power of XSL to kind of tie it all together, which you can do some amazing things with. Was there another question?
Well, yeah. I had a little bit of a question just to go back to the earlier topic. So you haven't moved that decentralization to the individual units to update their...
Not yet. Not yet, but that's the plan, is to distribute that workload to... I mean, right now, again, it's just two folks in arts and sciences who are responsible for the bulletin. And right now, they're the two that are, you know, doing the updates.
Okay,
but the idea is...
Okay. What I was going to ask, I'm sorry, but how was that transition from with them working in Quark to them working in the content management system to do the updates? Was that a hard transition?
It wasn't hard because they hated working in Quark.
Okay.
So... They, you know, they they looked forward to, you know, to doing something new. And again, the printed bulletin, none of the information was database, and they were basically starting it, you know, from scratch each year. And it was not just two of them. For the printed bulletin, then we had an editor on the communications staff that worked with them, who did all the editing, and then it went through copy editing. So there were other folks involved. So you can talk about the number of people involved in the printed. It was quite a bit. Now, again, it's, you know, these two are able to update it in the CMS. But again, they look forward to where they can actually distribute that work. And yeah, and I don't know what they'll do. I mean, they'll have a lot of free time, I suppose. They'll come up with something else. Sorry.
One of the processes of creating that catalog is a significant amount of review, edit, review, edit, review, edit. Mm-hmm. What is kind of workflow did you come up with in this project?
For the bulletin, right, in terms of review, the editor and his assistant will be getting changes. They'll be making the changes in the CMS, and then they are, the way it's working now is they're, the way we have it set up is we have a sort of a work and copy version of the bulletin and then the live version. So what's happening is that the changes are coming through, and that's happening actually now for the spring until I think October 15th is the deadline. Again, remember, I don't know who follows deadlines, but that's the deadline. Then they're sending the link out basically to review to the department, the department says to please review your department information. I mean, the departments are the ones who've sent the information, so theoretically it should be okay, but they're asking just for leaving a week to review, a week or 10 days for review, and then any changes. And then the live date for the spring bulletin will be November 1st. So there's that bit into it, but moving forward, what they'll probably do is build an actual workflow, like where departments can make the changes, and then department heads can review and be approvers. That workflow hasn't been built yet. We just launched this in August. So we're kind of at the beginning stages in terms of the workflow. And like I said, right now it's just getting started. But we'll probably build in a workflow where you'll have approvers at the department head level approve, you know, before the new bulletin goes live.
Nick.
Somebody had.
Yeah. Are you repurposing this content anywhere else on the site outside of the bulletin kind of area, like the department level sites or anything like that?
Not yet, but we plan on doing that. In PeopleSoft, I think it's maintained in the registrar's office.
And that's where all the changes to actual courses
happen. Yeah, that's where if there's a new course or a description change or a credit change, that's happening there.
Well, the XS, as Michael pointed out, we actually helped quite a bit in our professional services group. Write the XSL for them. However, it's not a requirement that we as a vendor of the software do that. We simply happen to have the staff that can help. So if you've got people that can write XSL, wonderful. You can do everything that you need to do. Okay, so let's move right along here so that we can maybe get out of here a little early even. Just to recap then how things work here, the XML is being pulled out of PeopleSoft such that PeopleSoft, and it's interesting to hear Michael say, I don't know, the registrar is maintaining that information. I mean, the nice thing is you're getting something that's structured, that's usable, that's correct by design, and you're simply reutilizing that in a new way and transforming that into a really powerful way. So that's coming out of PeopleSoft. In the OmniUpdate OU Campus system, the files, the XML files, are called PCFs, and these files then merge with other static content and other content that might be maintained at the department level, this high-level information about the department itself and so forth, such that the XML can be merged with the static content, the PCFs, through the XSLT process. That happens based upon the design in the XSL. XSLT then transforming the XML. XSLT containing instructions for the processor. And the XSLT processor engine itself is built into the CMS. If you're really curious, and I know you are because you're in this particular room, we're currently using Xalin, and that has its limitations based upon that project kind of petering out. But we're switching to Saxon, actually, hopefully later this month. So full XSLT 2.0, lots and lots of power. Anybody here good with XSLT 2.0? Okay. Anybody using Saxon? Okay. Xalin? Okay. Okay. Right. Well, amazing things going on in the XSL world these days. Truly, XSLT 2.0 has just got some incredible power. Actually, our CTO, Yves Lemperer, is here, and he's an expert in that. So if you want to pick somebody's brain about XSLT 2.0 and some of the things that you might be flabbergasted that you can do these days, talk to us. And then finally, of course, content being separate from the design, you've got all the power and the advantages and the ability to output to multiple formats, as we talked about, doing things that Stony Brook just couldn't do before without reverting back to the Quark data and generating PDFs independently, which might be out of sync with the actual content that's in PeopleSoft.
Just as a wild guess, have you thought about trying to do a mobile version of this as well?
Yes. No, that's definitely something we're interested in doing. I mean, just in general, mobile. I mean, that's one of the nice things about XML is being able to output it as mobile. We haven't done much with mobile, but this is definitely something we've talked about.
You know, the great thing about XML is it's so malleable. You know, you can output it to a light version for Windows Mobile. You could output it into a format that was sucked in by an iPhone app, too. I mean, you know, there's amazing things you can do. I don't know if you've looked at Duke University's iPhone app and what they've been able to do with it, but you know, they're feeding XML into that and just doing magical things. So it's great. So then the technology overview, again, really simply the course information system, no matter what that might be, you're going to be able to get XML out of that, or you're going to be able to transform the content from a data structure into a well-formed XML data structure. So you get the XML data. That goes through, in this case, the OU Campus product, which is the CMS, but you might be using something else. The additional information, as we alluded to a moment ago, thank you, Michael Finan, for pointing out the fact that that's actually one of the biggest challenges in this process. You can automate everything except for that, and you've still got to put some human input into this to fill in the descriptions and so forth that might be the high-level overview. Processing that with the XSLT process and then outputting that public-facing website in addition to other type of components or other type of files that might be a part of that. So let me turn it over to Michael to kind of wrap up with what's going on with phase two here.
Yeah, phase two, we just want to be able to pull course schedule information, which also is also in PeopleSoft, and display that information alongside the course information and the course descriptions. And that's something we hope to do also with a rebuild of our registrar site, again, since the registrar, they're the ones who are maintaining this information in PeopleSoft. And that's actually something that University of Buffalo does very nicely. And just as an aside, two of the folks that we kind of talked to about online course catalogs were Mark Greenfield at Buffalo and Rachel Rubin at SUNY New Paltz, two fellow SUNY schools. We talked to them, talked about their process and looked at their sites and got a lot of good ideas from them. And then additional printing options. And we have several already, but the idea of being able to print maybe sections of the front matter, the overview, or the policies, and we're looking to do that as well. So in terms of lessons learned, get buy-in early and meet with all the stakeholders right from the get-go. You know, people, there was some resistance to change, obviously. We talked to faculty and advisors who could not do without that 500-page book, you know, and we didn't feel the same way. But it's very important to meet with all the stakeholders at the start, whether it's faculty, people from the provost office, advisors. Get everybody in the room and review their expectations, their requirements, the maybe legal requirements in terms of archiving the bulletin. In our case, the bulletin needs to be archived on the first day of the semester. So somebody who's matriculating in fall '09, the the requirements that they need to follow is for Fall 09. So you need to be able to archive. So all that stuff, get out of the way early. We learned that from experience. Also prepare your data, understand where it's coming from and how to get it with PeopleSoft. It's been very easy. Don't be afraid to change the process of the content. I talked about that before. It's a good opportunity to not only look at the content and decide, you know, what do you need in the bulletin or the catalog and what don't you need, but also the process. I mean, it's a different technology. It's a new process. There might be ways to improve, you know, how you're doing things. Take advantage of user testing. Again, we had students look at this early on, and they gave us good ideas. Also, advisors and faculty members, we previewed it to them, and they gave us some ideas in terms of navigation. And then plan for the future. In our case, we're going to be doing the graduate bulletin next. We have a health sciences center that we also print a bulletin for. And again, from our perspective at the Office of Communications, we've been spending all this money printing out these bulletins. We're now moving ahead and having them online this way. And we feel it's a huge improvement. And again, from a cost savings, it's significant. So we've been discussing a little bit as we've gone along, so maybe we'll just leave the rest of the session for more questions.
Yeah. Seth?
Do you have a sense of how many people are using
the PDF? No. The exact numbers, no. Honestly, I think most of the folks using the print PDF are advisors. You know, I don't think students are doing that at all. Students might be printing the program PDF. You know, if they're in environmental studies and they just want to print it out to have, I mean, I think the program PDFs are the most useful, just to have a copy of the courses for a particular program. The front matter, well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, the front matter might be useful also. I mean, we do have those options on the homepage to print the entire bulletin. I can't imagine who's doing that, but that was a requirement of the project, and so we did that. Bless you. And you could also print all of the courses out, which, again, I don't think is as useful as the particular program, the course for that particular program as opposed to every course. But again, from just anecdotally, the folks who are most interested in that, I think, are the advisors and faculty members. So, anyone else? No, we haven't had any. The mid-semester updates would probably be in forms like a policy change that takes place immediately. We haven't had any of those yet.
In terms of the number of courses or course number changes?
No, that's done on a semester basis. We haven't had, I mean, that might happen, which just hasn't happened yet. Again, we just launched in August.
Yeah,
so.
The biggest problem we have is we're trying to look into what we're doing. Literally, we stopped creating a schedule of classes, but yet I still have to print a PDF copy for people to look at if they want to have on the desk, but I have to usually have to put and print as a date on there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Not yet. But just to get back with the PDFs, I mean, again, we mentioned before that disability support services, they were one of the driving elements in this. I mean, we had other reasons to do it as well. But, again, I talked about phase two with the course schedules. On Stony Brook's website now, if you wanted to get course schedules online, you're printing out a huge PDF of schedules, and I'm sure that a lot of people are in the same boat. So to be able to pull the schedule information, and I think that's going to be a huge addition. I mean, we packed a lot into this phase one in terms of search and all that stuff, but to pull the schedules, and that's the next, I mean, I think that's going to be the next logical step. But
can we take a look at the PDF really quick? Yeah, let's show it.
Yeah, well, I kind of moused over it before. I didn't go ahead and show the whole thing, but was this the whole PDF? Or yeah, this is the big one. It's like 400 pages. That was one of the nice things. We were able to format it, three columns, headers, all that. I mean, it's so it outputs a nice PDF. I mean, this is big. We're getting there, almost.
Almost
9.
And this is not the one most people would print,
no,
obviously.
No,
but
no.
anyway, just, you know, nicely formatted, multi-column. You know, you can just do amazing things in XSL. Let's get to the, where's the multi-column stuff here?
I think the, well, the program stuff might be. Yeah, I think so.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Let me go back to the one of the smaller ones. It's just nice, the three-column format and everything is just, which one would it be, this one?
Descriptions, I think, is three-column.
Nice and fast. Yeah, just, you know, nice looking stuff that you can do with XSL. It's amazing. All right. Any other questions? We're 5 minutes early. Let's go get something to eat or drink. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.